Okay, all right. Boyd, what is your full name?
Boyd Marlon Mundhink.
And where do you currently reside?
At 619 East 7th Street in Kinsley.
And when and where were you born?
I was born April 29th, 1940, out at the farmhouse southeast of Lewis.
And what were the names of your parents?
My father was Merle Mundhink, and my mother was Cleela.
What's her maiden name?
Her maiden name was Fisher.
And your grandparents?
Okay. My father's father was Delmer Mundhink, and he lost his first wife, which is my dad's mother, and her name was Minnie. And my father grandfather Delmer remarried to Eva Corner a few years later in 1908.
What was Minnie's maiden name?
Maila.
How would you spell that?
M-A-L-I-N.
Like it sounds. And then your maternal grandparents?
Okay, my mom's parents were A.B. Fisher, and his wife was Lula, L-U-L-A.
And the Fisher is spelled?
F-I-S-H-E-R.
Okay, and what was her maiden name?
Her maiden name was Parker.
And what? Describe what your household was like. Brothers, sisters, or?
Okay, I grew up I had three sisters, older sister and twin sisters, a year and a half younger than me.
What were their names?
Minnie Lou was my older sister, and my twin sisters were Loreen and Loretta.
And how did your family come to Kansas?
My grandfather, Delmer Mundhink, was from Morrisonville, Illinois. And he got married in 1905 and had a baby boy, my father, Merle, and 6 months later, his wife, Minnie, died from ruptured appendix. And so Delmer was really depressed and upset, so he wanted to start over with a new life, and that encouraged him to move to Kansas. And he had some relatives, really, from his wife's family, the Malins, and they had gotten established at Lewis, Kansas. So that was the reason that he moved to Lewis. And of course he had a 6 month old baby that his relatives were able to take care of for the first 2.5 years of my dad's life. And then he got remarried in 1908, and then he also bought the farmstead where our farm is southeast of Lewis in 1908.
Can you just describe a little bit what it was like growing up on the farm?
Well, in the 40s and 50s, when I was on the farm, things were quite a bit different than they are today here in 2011. But the biggest difference probably was we had lots of different chores and livestock, and wheat was the major crop. This was prior to irrigation, and wheat and milo were the two dry land crops that were primarily raised. But we had milk cows, chickens, hogs, the whole gamut of chores that, and a big garden, and a little orchard with fruit trees. So we did a lot of you might say providing a lot of our food, and of course my dad would separate the milk, have cream, and we'd take cream to town, excess cream, and be able to sell it. And we'd take eggs to the grocery store, and you could trade in your eggs for groceries, and so it cut down on your expenses.
Now, did those eggs and cream, did they stay in Lewis, or would they put on the train? And
we had the cream was put on the train there at the depot in Lewis. The eggs, we just traded them in at the grocery store.
There were enough town people to consume them.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, did your chores differ from your sister's chores?
Oh yes. I primarily did the outside chores. My sisters, they did things in the house, and of course we picked fruit. We had cherry trees, and we crab apples, and we had a big raspberry patch in our yard, and they were really tough to pick. And then they would process the fruit, can it, and freeze it, and so forth.
Did your dad have to have any other help besides you on the farm?
Oh yes, he always had a full-time hired man, and in the summertime he would have a high school boy working. And so that was about the size of his operation.
How many cows did you have? About?
Oh, we always had, I'd say, from 3 to 5 cows, which was a, as far as I was concerned, as I got into high school, a major inconvenience. And 7 days a week, morning and night, milking was not my idea of what I wanted to end up doing in life.
And you rode the bus to school? Or?
Yes. Yes, we had a school bus that picked us up and brought us back. And it seemed like that wasn't a big deal to... we did have athletics, but we did those during school time, and
oh, like the basketball team practiced during school?
As I remember, that's the way it was. And so we we could still go back home on the bus.
And do your chores.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, at this time, has there been consolidation? Are Truesdale and Centerview, and are those are all into Lewis by this time?
Actually, Truesdale did not come to Lewis. Fellsburg and Centerview were the two small communities that did feed into Lewis. And
Truesdale went to Maxville, or?
At first they went to Belfry.
Belfry.
And then later they ended up at Maxville.
So when you were in school, there was a school at Belfry?
Yes, yes. Yes.
And so the county schools would have been Kinsley, Lewis, and Belfry, and Offerly at that time? Offerly?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Did you play any sports, or?
I went out for sports. I wasn't terribly talented as an athlete, and I think almost everybody, the boys. Now we didn't have girls' sports then, but the boys pretty much went out for every sport. Unless there was some really major problem, that was just kind of a foreground conclusion.
Were you in the band or any other extracurriculars?
Yes. Yes, yes, I was in the band, played trumpet, and was not that, well, I was actually in some singing groups, but I was not that great of a singer, but I did follow the band, and I followed that even into college.
How many kids were in your graduating class, about?
I believe we had 25 in my graduating class in 1958.
And then did you go into church in Lewis too, or at that
time? Yes, yes. We went to the Methodist Church at Lewis. And, yeah, that was a pretty big part of our lives, and it was a pretty pretty active church that's had quite a bit, probably quite a few more attending than even today, I would guess.
No, I was going to think I couldn't make a hazard a guess at what the attendance was at my church when I was a teenager, but
no.
You know, you think it was quite a bit larger than now.
Yes, I'd say so. And it seemed like there were a lot of other church activities that were kind of scattered throughout the year and kind of important.
And then what other churches were in Lewis at that time?
Oh, they had Christian Church, Baptist Church, I believe, maybe Church of Christ. I think that was it.
Four churches. What was the business community like then?
Oh, the business community was We had two grocery stores.
Now, did your family go to both grocery stores, or did you have one that you?
No, I think they went to, mm-hmm. to each one sometime. We had a doctor, Dr. McFessel, and we had a dentist, Dr. Crawford. We had a jewelry store, and of course we had a drug store where you could fill prescriptions, and had a soda fountain, and we had two barber shops, for the men, and I can remember just one beauty shop. For sure, always one cafe, and sometimes they had two cafes. They had a pool hall, which was a pretty popular source of entertainment, and we had a skating rink on the north end of Main Street, where the Lewis Co-op shop is today. And we had a hardware store that was pretty complete. We had a shoe repair shop, and of course the telephone office. We
Now, can you remember when you got a telephone, or are you young or old enough to always had one?
We got a telephone, I believe it was in about the same time we got REA electricity. That was in 1947. I would have been like 7 years old. And we might have gotten a telephone, I'd say within a year or two, either way of that, maybe mid-40s.
And before you got REA, did you use ice or?
No, my dad had what was called a Kohler plant, and it was operated on natural gas, mm-hmm. and it would generate electricity. Mm-hmm. It was pretty uptown for the for the times.
Would you say you were a better off farmer, or a average, or as far as your standard of living?
We were not a really big farming operation, but I guess we were what I would say kind of average, maybe a little bigger than average in terms of size, but you know, my dad ran cattle in the winter time. He would buy calves and feed them or graze them on wheat, and then dryland wheat and dryland milo. So it was not it was not jam-packed with all kinds of things to do every single week of the year, like today's farming, irrigating, cattle businesses are. You know, we kind of fill up every single week with no downtime.
Yeah, and harvest into the middle of the night even.
Right.
Well, one other thing about Lewis, how about gas stations?
Yes, we had quite a few gas stations. I'd say probably at least three. And another thing I forgot about, we had a Ford garage. And you could buy cars and trucks there, and that was a pretty successful business for several years.
Now, before the war, we learned, you know, how important, you know, going to town on Saturday was. Was that still that way when you were growing up?
Yes, it was. That was a big thing. Saturdays. And you know, I was raised, went to school in Lewis, but I had a lot of ties and experiences in Kinsley also, because My mom's parents moved into Kinsley in 1935 when they retired from their farm in Fellsburg, Kansas. And so we would come to Kinsley every Saturday afternoon and evening, it seemed like. And later on, one of the two activities that I remember quite a bit was going to the skating rink here in Kinsley almost every Saturday night, and then also the movie theater. So,
and Lewis didn't have a movie theater, right? Or
no, there was not a movie theater at Lewis.
Now, you mentioned your grandparents' farm. Who took over that farm when they retired?
My grandparents in Fellsburg?
Yeah, that came to Kinsley.
Okay. My uncle, C.O. Fisher.
Okay. So that stayed in the family?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, let's see. There's something else I thought of. Out of my head, though.
The skating rink, was it in the South Park? Is that where you went skating?
No, the skating rink that was out here west of town. It was just beside the VFW.
Okay, you said that you didn't irrigate. Was there a lot of use of chemical fertilizers or insecticides at that time, or
no.
Did you see changes?
No, actually, farming up until, I would say, the mid to late 1950s, most all people did not even use fertilizer. It was only in that period of time that they were starting to realize that the soil was getting a little bit depleted, and they needed to start putting on some fertilizer.
Did they use manure? Did they put that on the fields?
No.
Not nothing.
Well, nothing for a long, long time. And then they got some commercial fertilizer,
mm-hmm.
that was in the, I'd say it was in the 50s when it was started. And you didn't put it on every year, but maybe every other year.
And what were the yields back then?
The yields were probably 10 to 20 bushel wheat would probably catch most of it.
Okay, did we have our person who's helping with this had this question, which I thought was interesting. Did anyone have to work off farm at that time for income to help support the farm like we do today? When did that, do you remember when that started?
Okay. Now, during the my growing up period in the 40s and 50s, most people that were able to make a go of farming pretty much did that full time. But one thing that really did happen in the 50s. When a generation of farmers got old enough to retire, or I'd say maybe when they hit 60 or so, there were two things that really helped farmers in retirement during that period of time in the 50s. And one was a soil bank program that Eisenhower came out with during his period of presidency. And it was sort of like the CRP today. You could plant your fields to grass, and then you could get a payment back from the government every year, and so you didn't need to farm it. Okay, that combined with the state hospital in Larned was I don't know when it was established, but I know in the decade of the 50s there were quite a few of our neighbors who were hitting retirement age, or I'd say in the maybe 60s, early 60s, and they would put their farm into this soil bank program and drive to Larned to work at the state hospital. So that was kind of a convenient thing that worked out for a fair number of farmers.
And then did that give them more for retiring with Social Security or a state retirement, or was it just for income at that time?
I think it was a steady, reliable income.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Now, in your family, we'll probably get to it in a little bit, but you were inherited or took over the farm, and is that what did you start farming before you? Why did your parents retire? Did you join your father to farm later?
Okay,
I guess I'm getting ahead.
I could kind of summarize this a little bit. When I was growing up, even when I first started the high school, or maybe even before, my mom was always asking me, "When are you going to come back and take over this farm?" And she asked me so many times that I was almost rebelling to think that's not in the plan, and so I was really not that interested in farming, and honestly, things were not terribly profitable, and not a lot of things were really changing or happening during the decade of the 60s. We were raising lots and lots of wheat, and we were putting up these big grain elevators in every single little town along the railroad, and we were filling them up with wheat, and it was way more wheat than could be used or sold or exported. And so the government had a program where they sort of paid you a little bit to carry that wheat over. So we were building a huge surplus, and I could see that, you know, things were just not happening much in agriculture. It was kind of like watching paint dry, in my opinion. And so then, jumping ahead here, when I had an opportunity to go into the Peace Corps in 1961, I jumped at the chance, and I was wanting to see the world and see other places and experience new things. And when I came back, then I got into teaching. I really, really enjoyed teaching, and I probably would have liked to have stayed with that, but I was the only boy, three sisters, and so I was realizing that you know, I had a good opportunity economically to come back and take over my family farm. And ultimately, that's what I did in 1970s when I actually...
And what did your sisters do?
Oh, my oldest sister, Minnie Lou, she went to K-State and graduated in home ec and education. She taught for several years, got married to a banker, and let's see.
And where did she end up? She did not come back here?
No. She ultimately ended up in Oakley, Kansas for most of their time, and then later she moved to Hutchinson. One of my twin sisters, Loretta, she graduated with a degree in physical therapy, and she worked at that for several years. She married a guy who ultimately went to medical school, and he's a family practice doctor. They moved to Wellington, Kansas. My other twin sister graduated in home ec and education. She taught school for quite a few years, and she married a guy that in Wisconsin, that she settled actually in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And
I'm interested, was this unusual that all four of your children would go to college at this time, or was this the trend? Or why education was important to your parents? Or
yes, it was a foregone conclusion in my family that we were going to college.
Did your parents go attend college?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they both did.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing that was different, I think significantly different, back in those times, the 50s and 60s, was going to college and getting an education was a matter of what field you chose and what you wanted to do, because you knew when you got out that you would have some different options and pretty good opportunities to have employment or a career. Unfortunately, That has changed a whole lot in the last 20 years, to where a college education is not your passport to a very productive career necessarily, and that's a sad fact that we have to deal with.
Well, okay, so you graduated in
58,
and you went up to K-State and started a degree in education. When you went up there, is that what you thought you were going to do?
Actually, I started out in agriculture.
Yep.
The first 3 years, or maybe two, maybe the first year and a half or 2 years, and I became a little disenchanted with that, and I decided if I was going to come back and be in the farming business, I was not learning what I needed to do in those classes. And they were kind of hard science classes that I wasn't that interested in. So I changed and decided I would like to be a teacher and maybe combine that with agriculture. And so that's what I did.
And then what brought about your change to go into Peace Corps in the middle of the college education?
Okay. In 1960, before, President Kennedy was running for office in the fall of 1960. I became very, very interested in his campaign, and I actually worked with it and went door to door with brochures and whatnot in Manhattan when I was there. My third year in college. Then a very significant thing happened. That spring of 1961, I was going to a Methodist youth group there at college, and they were having an inside government seminar in Washington, D.C. and New York over spring break, I believe the last part of March. So we studied up on a lot of foreign relation topics, and we then went on this trip. And one of the things that was significant to me was a book called The Ugly American. It was actually written in 1958, but it had to do with, it was a fictionalized story of a country in Southeast Asia. I believe it was for... it was actually representing Vietnam, and these Americans would go there, and they would not associate with the local people. They became very interested in having a high lifestyle, and it really was a bad rap on what we were doing overseas with foreign development and combating the communist threat, which was getting to be a big thing at that time in the Cold War. And so this really piqued my interest with how we were doing such a poor job of helping these third world countries develop. Then the next part of the story, when Kennedy was won the presidency in March of that year, he set up the Peace Corps, and so I was right there, you might say, with a front row seat to what was happening because of this trip to Washington, D.C. So I came back to K-State, and there was a Peace Corps recruiter that came on campus in the beginning of April, I believe, in that year. And he encouraged me to sign up for the Peace Corps if I wanted to.
Let's see. So you, at this time, was the... I'm a little younger than you, and people could go in the Peace Corps to avoid the draft. Was there the draft going on for Vietnam during this time? Was...
Okay.
Or any of that?
That's a very important thing that happened in my life. Vietnam was not really heating up until about 1963 and 64. And I spent 3 months traveling back through Southeast Asia when I finished my tour of duty in the fall of 63. And I was planning to visit and spend some time in Vietnam, as well as every other country there. But the President Diem was assassinated. I believe it was in August when when I was in Thailand, and things were getting very tense. And so I was not able to actually do anything more than just sit down at the airport in Saigon. But when I got back to the States, my dad had written to me when I was in Japan and said that I was classified 1A with my draft board, and that I had better get back to the States. And so I got back into college, and that actually helped, especially I think in these small counties where we didn't have such a big number that were having to be drafted. But the upshot is, when I came back, I really knew what was going on over there, and I knew that we were setting ourselves up for an unwinnable war. And so the real buildup came, actually war was declared in 1964 when President Johnson declared the war, and 1965 was when we had a huge buildup. Something like 500 to 600,000 troops were committed in 1965. Okay, during this time, after I get back from Peace Corps, I was in college at K-State, and I was becoming one of those rebel rousers that was really, really passionately against the war in Vietnam. And I actually was going to do anything I could to avoid being drafted and going to Vietnam. I was talking about going to Canada or something else. But I mean, I spent 2 years of really lots and lots of hardships and work in the Peace Corps. And I really was wanting to serve my country, but this was not in it for me, the Vietnam thing. And so, ultimately then, as we marched through the 60s, 1968 was kind of the watershed year, because Eugene McCarthy had come out to run against President Johnson, and he was the anti-war candidate. He was running on the idea that if he were to be president, he was going to withdraw us from the war. And so then, ultimately, Johnson backed off and decided he was not running again in March of 1968. And then we had a terrible bloodbath of a Democratic convention that August. And lots of really significant things happened then that changed the whole society of our country.
Yeah, I think we're going to take a little break then.
Okay,
we're going to go back then. You had a recruiter come to campus, and you decided to sign up for the Peace Corps. Then what was the procedure after? Oh, yes, yeah, sorry. What was the procedure after that? We've got to get our microphone back on here. Get that?
Okay, so I met a recruiter in April of 61, and he encouraged me to go ahead and sign up for the Peace Corps, even though I did not have a college degree. At first I thought I would not even be eligible, but since I had a farm background, he encouraged me to apply, and that actually turned out to be the situation. I was able to work in agriculture, and it wasn't necessary that I have a degree for what I was doing in Peace Corps. I started out working with water buffaloes, and then later I decided.
Well, before you get there, what was your training before they sent you to Pakistan? Did you learn language?
Yes. So I went to training in Fort Collins, Colorado, at the end of August, and we had, I believe it was 3 months of training there, and it was very intensive. About 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and we had intensive language training in Urdu. And
a second, we're gonna flip this one over. Okay.
After our training in Fort Collins, and we were the first group that they had trained, and we were also the first group that went to West Pakistan.
You were in the very first
yes.
class
that went to West Pakistan.
Oh, okay.
There were probably maybe 6 or 8 groups that started training that summer of 61. There were a few African countries and a few in Asia, a few in Latin America that went that first summer. After our training in Fort Collins for 3 months, we had a homestay for about a week.
Stop right there. How did your parents feel about this decision you've made to go into the Peace Corps?
Oh, my parents were devastated that they thought it was a really bad idea, and it was not in their game plan for what I should be doing. And it wasn't until about 6 weeks or so into the training in Fort Collins that we had to have, or they did, an FBI check on all of the a very, very extensive background check of everybody who had gone into training. And so one of the farmer friends, neighbors of my dad, was interviewed by this FBI agent, and he came over and talked, this neighbor came over and talked to my dad and told him all the questions they were asking about me and my family and everything, and so my parents sort of thought, well, maybe this is a little bit restrictive, and so by the time I was getting out of training, they were all for it and thought it was a pretty good deal. But after three months of training in Colorado, then we had 1 month of training in Puerto Rico. And then this was kind of an outward bound type of thing. We did some hiking in the rainforest area, and we were split up in groups, and we did lots of different kinds of activities, a lot of physical stuff. And we continued to have our language training every single day. And then we went to West Pakistan, and a shower is where we landed in the very northern part of the country.
And how would you spell that?
P-E-S-H-A-W-A-R.
Okay.
And we had at least a month of intensive training there before we were distributed around the country with our jobs.
And where were you sent, and what did your job become?
Okay, I was sent to Lyallpur, which was sort of in the middle of the country, in the Punjab. They had an agricultural college there, and I was supposed to be sort of like an ag extension agent. But honestly, our jobs, since we were the first group there, our jobs were really not established, or we had to live there for several weeks and kind of develop a niche of what we could do. And I started out trying to work with water buffaloes, and I found that this was probably going to be a 3 to 5 year kind of a window of time to do very much. And ultimately, what I kind of zeroed in on was working with chickens. And I sort of copied some things that a missionary friend from the States was doing in building cages and confining chickens for better production and so forth.
How did the people feel about you?
The native people were very very receptive and very friendly to us. And when we would go out to their villages, we were treated like royalty, actually. And one of the problems we had was the sanitation and the food and water. Particularly the water was not very safe to drink. And so we had many bouts of dysentery and lots of problems with getting adjusted to that. That was a pretty major deal, really.
How many of there were you in the Peace Corps?
Okay, there were 28.
28
in our group.
Weston.
Mm-hmm.
And was your living more on the peoples, or were you, I mean, well, where did it fit in between what you're used to here in the States and what the natives?
Okay.
Was it a dorm? Was it a...
We had a small group that I was with. I believe there were six, or maybe we started out with eight. That we hired a cook, and he would go to the bazaar every day and buy food and come back and prepare it for us. And we collectively lived together. We had little individual rooms. No running water. We had to take dip baths and shave in cold water. So I ultimately grew a beard.
It was Did your diet change because of what was available, or?
Oh yes. We would have whatever fruit was in season in the bazaar, and you'd get pretty kind of almost sick and tired of something, and then the season would change a little bit, and you'd have something else. But it was mostly native type food that we ate.
And now with the Peace Corps, did the government pay you, or I mean, what was the compensation?
We had a per diem allowance, and I believe that was like about $35 a month, and that doesn't seem like much at all, but it didn't cost a lot to live there. We didn't have to pay for our room, and so, and then the salary that we earned was $2 a day. For the time we spent, and we got this allowance when we terminated our service.
And was it both men and women?
Yes. And really, four main categories of work. Agriculture was one, teaching was one, nursing was one, and there were a few that were like engineers, and we had one guy who was a bricklayer.
What else would we like to know about this?
The religion, did all Muslim? Is that?
Yes. Most people there were Muslims, and there were a few Christians, but they were pretty much the bottom of the pecking order. But most of them were Muslims, and this was long before the terrorism that we've been experiencing here for the last 10 or 15 years. But the government was sort of a military rule, but it was very friendly to the states, and it was a good time to be in Pakistan, and things really changed in the late 80s after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and then things really changed a whole lot.
Well, did you get a chance to go like on touristy things to go see some of the sites in Pakistan?
Yes, we did, or I did, and I even went on a pretty extensive little vacation in the middle of my tour of duty. I went over to Beirut and Jerusalem and visited the Holy Lands and Syria at Christmas time, actually, in after the first year I was there. But in general, I think we got maybe one day of vacation per month, and most people build it up to the end, and so then when I got finished and terminated over there, I got a plane ticket back to the States that I could fill in whenever I wanted to. So I went to every single country along the way, and then visited and got contacts with lots of sometimes Americans who were living in those countries, and sometimes Peace Corps volunteers. who were actually working in some of those countries. And so I was able to live on a shoestring and travel with public transportation, buses and trains, for little or nothing. And so it was not, you know, it was not a tourist type experience in a way. It didn't cost that much to do it.
And how many months did you spend coming home? I mean,
I spent 3 months.
3 months
coming home, and that in itself was an experience that was just as almost rewarding and interesting as the 2 years that I spent in Pakistan.
And you did not come back to Edwards County during that whole time. You didn't
no.
have a.
And the other thing that is kind of significant, never once did I make a telephone call back to the States. The only way of communication was letters, and I would write almost every single week. And it would take about 7 days for a letter to get from here to there. And so that was, you might say, pretty isolating experience that is not like it is today. Peace Corps volunteers today go with their laptops, and they have their websites, and even cell phones, and so it's like almost that you're not actually getting into another culture or different place.
Now, when you were working with your chickens or whatever, did you have to go back a couple decades as far as, you know, was there electricity or where they were doing this, or was it pretty much the same state as the States would have been to set up a chicken poultry place?
No, it was moving back in time, probably 50 years from where we were here. And but in terms of electricity, we did have electricity in our Peace Corps hostel where we lived. But the villages were sort of hit and miss. There were some villages that had electricity in a small area of the part of them, but it wasn't universal at all. They didn't have electricity and running water in most.
So you were going back in time as far as setting up this production, poultry
yes.
production.
Oh yes, yes.
Well, did they like Americans? I mean, you know, you talked about the ugly Americans and all that. Did they see you as one of them ugly Americans too, or?
Oh no, they had a lot of good friendships with us, and we were. Like I say, in many cases, if we go into a village, we were kind of treated like royalty, and they thought that it was really quite something that somebody from America was coming to try to help them and do something for them. Now, quite often, if you try to find out what their basic needs were, they say, "Oh, we just need some money. We need more money," and you'd have to dig a lot deeper to find out what there was that you could actually help them do with some changes in their farming practices or their ways of hygiene or whatever that they were doing.
So, we were talking a little bit on our break, but with your relationship with the Kennedy family and Sergeant Shriver, who just recently passed away, because you were at the very beginning of the Peace Corps when it was quite a small organization, I assume. And
yes, yes, and actually, this Peace Corps idea was I've read one of the more successful things that the President Kennedy is remembered for with what he called the New Frontiers, passing the torch to a new generation and so forth. But one of the kind of neat experiences that we had with our group was Jackie Kennedy had decided to come to India and Pakistan that first year that we were there in the Peace Corps. And so Jackie was going to the airport in Lahore, and she requested that she wanted to meet the Peace Corps volunteers there. And this was kind of interesting because a lot of the foreigners, the Americans who were working there in the United States Information Service, the State Department, the U.S. Consul, and different places, they were looking forward to being able to see the First Lady and so forth. And she requested the Peace Corps is who she wanted to see, and so we got ushered up to the very front of the line, and I was, I believe, the second person that was able to shake her hand and visit with her a little bit. And so this was kind of a big experience that we had. And then well, to not ramble on here too long about this, when I got back to the States and got back into college, I had gone through Southeast Asia and had seen the buildup of the problem in Vietnam, and so I was getting to be very upset about our position with our country, wanting to go into Vietnam and fight the communists, which was, in my opinion, kind of an unwinnable war. The French had come to this very same conclusion in the 50s, after World War II, and back then Eisenhower had sent quite a bit of money to the French to help them throw back the communists out of North Vietnam. And so when I got back to college, and I was getting to be a very anti-war student, and so then I was trying at all costs to keep from being drafted into this war. And I actually had several friends who had gone to the Peace Corps and then got back home and ended up getting drafted to go to Vietnam. And I was just really upset about this. But I got it. I finished at K-State in January of '66 and then went to Kansas City and took a teaching job in the Kansas City, Missouri school system. And I learned how to deal with a whole new set of problems and social issues with the racially integrated school that I was teaching in. We had a lot of blacks that would bust into the school, and so we had a pretty unstable kind of a social setting. And then in 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of that year, my school, as well as all of the other schools in that inner city area, were just absolutely turned upside down. And finally, after trying to hold school for one day, they turned all the classes out a week early for Easter, and we had like about 8 or 10 days off to get things settled down. We came back after that little break, things were not settled down. It was like teaching on pins and needles for the entire rest of that school year, and there was just lots and lots of unrest, and so I really, coming from Lewis, Kansas, I did not have any experience in dealing with blacks and other racial minorities, except, you know, my Peace Corps experience was very helpful and very enlightening with some of the experiences that I had. But I would have to say that the teaching in Westport High in Kansas City, Missouri in the late 60s was equally, if not more challenging, actually, than serving in the Peace Corps in West Pakistan. It just was quite a made quite a an impression on me as the person that I kind of became.
We did not have on the tape the fact that you came back and became a recruiter, did we?
No.
Yeah. So maybe you'd want to pick up and talk about recruiting and JFK's death. And
okay. After returning home from the Peace Corps in the fall of 1963, after a couple of weeks at home, after my 2 years of being overseas, things were moving very, very slowly here, and I was getting a little bit bored. And the Peace Corps was actually wanting ex-Peace Corps volunteers to help recruit, so I volunteered for that. And went to several different places across the country, to mostly universities. And I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in late November, recruiting when President Kennedy was killed on a Friday afternoon, and I was showing a movie with President Kennedy talking about the Peace Corps, and so this was a extremely depressing time for me to deal with his death. most people that were old enough to remember can relate to what they were doing when he was killed. But I felt like I had quite a bit of identity with the Kennedys and with being in Peace Corps and so forth. And then I was scheduled to go into Washington, D.C. that next day to get some different orders for recruiting. And so I was back in Washington, D.C. for all of the funeral activities, and one of my old Peace Corps buddies from Pakistan was living in an apartment that was only two blocks away from St. Matthew's Cathedral, where President Kennedy's service was held. So we had a ringside seat. We could go out on the sidewalk and see the entire procession go by, and I took a zillion slides of every dignitary and every country that was represented and so forth. And so, you know, I really had a special kind of closeness, I guess, to President Kennedy in several different ways.
And then you said you became active when Bobby Kennedy, which was in the same period you were just talking about, in 68.
Yes, later than in 1968, when I was in Kansas City, and I had gone through a lot of extra turmoil there with Martin Luther King's assassination and my teaching. I was very interested in Bobby Kennedy's campaign, and was really getting pretty passionate about that. And then he was assassinated, I believe the 6th of June of that year. And so it was a lot of ups and downs, and you might say we were living in tumultuous times during the 60s. But 1968 was probably the watershed year that that then it kind of led on to a very confrontational Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August of that year, and lots of radical college students were protesting, and the police force in Chicago were beating them to a pulp with their billy clubs, and it was we were experiencing such violence from daily TV reports of the bloodbath that we were experiencing in Vietnam, and then we had it back in our own country with the protest movements that really was a time to remember. And
that this is going to be completely out of sequences, but you just said something about TV. When did you get TV as a kid?
Okay. We got our first TV in the mid-50s, and
so you pretty much grew up with TV.
Well, I was like in junior high or almost starting high school, I believe. And I'd say that TV was one of the things, the big things, that changed the social habits and experiences that we were all living with. Prior to having TV, you know, we would go skating and go to the movies, and sometimes people would go bowling, but we would visit other friends and neighbors. My parents actually belonged to a square dance club, and so we would, as kids growing up, we would tag along with that, and the kids would play cards or games. We had lots of social interaction, but with the TV, that sort of changed the whole dynamics of and it led on to other things that we've gone to now, where you get your entertainment at home, mm-hmm. whether it's the internet or TV or renting DVDs mm-hmm. or whatever.
Well, another question I have is, when does Nancy come into all of this picture?
Okay, I met Nancy in Kansas City when I was teaching there, and
what was she doing?
She was working at Hallmark Cards, and she had graduated from KU, and I believe that she was on her second or third year there by the time we got married. And at that time, I decided that my dad wanted to work out of his farming operation, and so the plan was that we would move back to Kinsley, and I would teach for a few years and help my dad on the farm there south of Lewis. Well, I did get a job teaching in Kinsley, and I taught 1 year, and the very first spring, my dad's hired man decided to quit, and so my dad was very upset and decided that he just wanted to get into retirement and not keep fighting things. So Nancy and I had kind of a soul-searching experience to decide to make the changes. So I actually went into a little partnership with my dad for about 4 years, starting in 1970, and then he completely retired in 1974, and I took things over. And the significant thing of starting at this time in farming that I would like to mention is that irrigation was just getting started.
This is 1970 or 70?
Right. And my dad had gotten his first center pivot irrigation in 1969, and put down two new irrigation wells. And so, like I kind of mentioned a long time ago, I thought that 1950s and especially 1960s was a time that nothing was happening much in terms of a lot of changes or much different things happening in agriculture, and that was the case. We were building up a big surplus of wheat, and the prices were not good, and so it was not all that productive of time to be in agriculture. But I've looked back many times and thought that 1970 was a real opportune time to get started in farming, and that's when I started, because we were just starting to develop irrigation, and so I became pretty active and was on the steering committee to set up the groundwater management district that is a 5-county area here that got started then in the mid-70s, and we at that time thought that every single quarter section of ground was going to be irrigated. It was just a matter of time before we had an irrigation well on every single quarter. And we happened to be in probably the garden spot of the state of Kansas for the best aquifer for pumping irrigation. But surprisingly enough, we started learning by the mid-80s that we were starting to mine our aquifer, and our water table was going down. And so in 1988, we had to declare a moratorium for no more water rights being issued. And so this is a little of the history of the irrigation, but
well. And now we're buying the water rights back, right? As on some places they're getting them back, so
no, I don't really.
Or retiring wells, is that what I want to say?
Okay, yes, that's right.
Okay, you left to go to college, and you came back 1969 or 70, was it, something like that?
Right.
Does anything stand out in your mind that were big changes in that time, other than irrigation?
Well, I'd have to say that during the decade of the 60s, what I think is kind of a significant thing that happened was, this was I believe it was in the mid 60s, is when the little plastic credit cards became available, and I think that has had a significant impact on the way people live, the way people think, and the way they operate their lives. And I certainly can remember when I got my first credit card. I think it was in 1967 or 68, and you know, it was kind of a big deal, but we still didn't use it that much. Mm-hmm. But I mean, today people have multiple credit cards and play both ends against the middle and usually come out way behind.
About how many kids in your class stayed in Edwards County, do you know? About? So you said there were 25 in the class, you said?
Yes, we had a 50-year reunion here 2 years ago, and I'd say we probably have like about 5 or 6 that maybe four or five that are here now.
And had they stayed here or did they come back?
Most had
stayed here, yeah. And were there many obvious changes to the business communities and stuff when you came back after being gone for 10 years?
Well,
or didn't it start to change as much at that time period?
Nancy and I moved back here in 69, and there were quite a few businesses on Main Street here in Kinsley that were still pretty active and viable, and we had like 2 drug stores and 3 grocery stores. And
did Lewis still have its 2 grocery stores? And
Lewis kind of got down to 1 grocery store.
Still had a pharmacy?
No, the pharmacy in Lewis, I think, was not here by the late 60s.
You said a hardware store? Was that still,
oh, yeah.
That was still there?
Yeah.
The only other person that I know that's been in the Peace Corps is Glenn Frame. And Glenn was your neighbor.
Oh, yes.
Did you ever talk to him about the Peace Corps or?
No.
Okay. I just wondered, since you were neighbors, he had a totally different lifestyle.
Well, we were kind of different generations.
Different generations,
too.
Yeah. But I just wondered, I mean, I've never talked to him why he joined the Peace Corps, but I just, you know, since you were neighbors, I just wondered if you had said, hey, you should join the Peace Corps.
I think he was gone from here and had done a few things when he joined the Peace Corps.
Okay.
He wasn't like right out of college. And I was pretty young. I was only like 20 years old when I got on the Peace Corps. I was on the very, very low end of the age.
As most people would have graduated from college, you said,
yeah,
before they went in.
Right.
So that made him a couple years older.
Right. And we had several that were like in their 30s that were actually in our group too.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that the older people. Oops. Been over a time. Well, we just about are, actually.
Well, have you read 3 Cups of Tea?
We have that book, and we can't seem to find it.
And there's a sequel to it now that we have that I cannot remember the name of.
We saw that last weekend when we were down at Watermark in Wichita.
Okay. But I was just, I mean, I've read 3 Cups of Tea, but that's, just, you know, I've never been any place. But it is still so primitive.
Right.
I mean, you build a bridge and you change the whole world.
Right. That's a benchmark book for that part of the world.
Okay, well, there's questions at the end. Summarize the highlights of your life for the last 40 years since 1970. So what's sort of happened in the last, what is that? That's 40 years, yeah.
Okay, my that's about how long I'd been farming since 1970, and
you are still actively farming?
No, I retired in 2008, and incidentally, this was the centennial year of when my grandfather Delmer first purchased that home quarter where our farm is, and so we were recognized as a century farm in 2008, And that happened to be the year that I took retirement, total retirement, and turned over the operation to my son, John. And John graduated from K-State in 1997, and he came back and worked with me and developed a cow herd of his own, and got some equity built up to where he could take things over, and after 10 years. So that's in terms of my 40 years of farming, and probably the last 15 to 20 years has been trying to set things up where John could take over this business. And as you probably know, this farming business is really, really tough to break into, and it requires so much capital, and it's a tough business. And I feel very fortunate and kind of blessed that we're able to pass our farming business on to a fourth generation. And so that's one of the big things that I've been working toward since got to the early 90s. When John was starting high school, he indicated that this definitely was the main passion of his life, and he wanted to come back and do that. So I've been kind of working toward that direction. And our daughter, Shelley, became very interested in becoming a doctor. So we've been kind of helping and trying to facilitate her education and things that she can do. And she's now an infectious disease specialist in Lincoln, Nebraska. So raising two kids was kind of full-time for us. Some people have five or six or more, but we were very, very busy with two. And
let's see. It says, looking back overall, how do you think living in Edwards County affected your life? Maybe affected your Peace Corps, and you know, you have a little different experience.
Okay, I really think it did have a big impact on my life. I think I received a very good education here. I think I learned a lot of important things about family values. I think I learned a lot about developing a good work ethic with all these chores that you do growing up on a farm, which comes in handy. And I think that I learned a lot of kind of common sense, kind of resourceful things that helped me quite a bit in the Peace Corps. Because, I mean, you have to, you might say, reinvent the wheel here and there and lots of different ways. And so I think my background here was very good, and that was one of the reasons that Nancy and I really wanted to raise our family here and live here. And even though it's not, doesn't have the glitz and glamour that a lot of places do, I guess during my period of seeing the world and experiencing a lot of different things in different places, even in this country, I came to realize that we have a lot of natural advantages for a good lifestyle here, and it's good to get away, to go to some of these maybe more exciting places, but we do have a lot of really good things here.
Well, maybe I'm going to further that question. Western Kansas is a pretty conservative area. From what you described of your college and your Peace Corps and your political persuasions, how was it coming back with those viewpoints into this conservative area? Did you have problems, or?
I don't think that's been a big issue, okay. But I have been I think you can find people about any place that share some common political, religious, social mm-hmm. kinds of values with you. Yes, I did experience an awful lot of things when I was traveling overseas and in the Peace Corps that you don't see and don't deal with here on a daily basis. Like when I was 20 years old and left Lewis, Kansas, I had never experienced dealing with gays and like I said before, blacks and minorities, and there's an awful lot of things that you realize in this day and age, the world is so much smaller, and we all see how we experience so many different lifestyles and religions and points of view that it's. I think no matter where you live, you will find people, and now with the internet and emailing, you know, you can send things back and forth with somebody that's in Washington State or New York or wherever that you're friends with, and you don't have to always just be dealing with your neighborhood where you live.
You kept in contact with your Peace Corps friends?
And yes. Kind of very, very unusually, our Peace Corps group has continued to stay in contact, and we have had many reunions, and actually the last time we got together was just 2 years ago. And we might even get together I think most of them are getting together in Washington, D.C. this next September for the 50-year reunion. And depending on my health, hopefully I can go too, but I'm not positive about that right now.
The population has continued to decrease since 1970. Have you seen other changes from 1970 to now?
Oh, yes. The way people live and the way businesses have changed, when the malls came in to the bigger cities, back in the 60s probably, that started changing things, and in these small towns and communities, it's impossible for a business to compete with a retail business that's selling the same thing that you can get in a bigger place. But these smaller towns, I think, continually are going to always need to have service businesses, and that's the main things that you do, you know, close to home.
So your repairman and your
yes, the grocer, the cafes, the liquor stores, the beauty salons, the doctors, if at all possible. That's a key part of a small community that's going to survive and continue on. Probably medical facilities and education are the two common denominators that determine whether a small town or community can.
I was, when you said that, I was just thinking even some of the governmental services are becoming more concentrated. I mean, your ag-related things, the counties are having to go together. I mean, it used to be every town had an ag agent and this, and now they're starting to share, so that even the government things have become less.
Exactly. And a lot of it gets down to budget issues and being able to subsidize or fund county extension programs is much more difficult than it used to be. And quite honestly, we have fewer and fewer people involved in production and agriculture. And that's probably, we've seen the biggest downsizing. There'll probably be a little bit more as time goes on, but I think that we've seen the biggest dramatic drops.
And that's because of mechanization, basically? Or?
Partly mechanization has got a lot to do with it. The other one is the economy of scale. You cannot have an economically viable business that operates on two or three quarter sections of land. It's just not like it used to be. Mm-hmm. When they used to have a family living on about every quarter section of land, it was, you know, it didn't cost as much to live. That's a real significant difference. And you didn't have to have all of these technological playthings and things that we use all the time. And so you had a bad year or you had a bad two or three years, you just tighten your belt a little bit more. And one of the things that I can remember growing up, we mom and my grandparents would constantly every year one of their projects was to make soap, and of course they always made butter regularly, and then made cheese, of course, with all the gardening and the fruit and so forth, that you could, and we butchered a hog and a steer every year, and so it didn't take a lot of outside spending mm-hmm. to get by. And that's totally different now.
And your mother made your sister's clothes?
Yes, quite a few. Mm-hmm.
So the last question is, what do you see for the future of Edwards County? Is it going to stay viable? Or?
I think Edwards County will continue to downsize probably a little bit more, but I'm hopeful and optimistic that we can continue to have a good education system and a good healthcare system. And both of these are kind of dependent on how funding gets set up. And I know the Obama health care plan that was passed last year is pretty complicated, and I don't think anybody can say totally how it's going to work out. But I have heard that it's going to have some benefits for small hospitals and health care facilities in terms of the reimbursements for Medicare, and you know, hopefully that can help us a little bit when it comes to education funding. Up to date, we've been able to do pretty well with the extra money that is provided for busing and things that we desperately need. With a low population and things, but it'll depend on how that shakes out. I think tourism could be a thing that could be developed a little bit more here, and we already have some. But I guess I'm optimistic about our irrigation potential that we have going forward, even though we are declining a little bit in our water table, but that really is sets us apart from a lot of other counties around us. And you go very much west of here and or north of here, and they don't have the opportunities that we have here with, I think, with our production agriculture and cattle. That's another thing that we can probably maintain and develop even more.